So, good morning and or afternoon, whatever day time of day it is that you happen to be listening to this. But thanks for tuning in to 96.3 Ohm Radio Charleston. I'm Whitney Powers, and I'm your host today for the series Small Talks, Big Ideas. It's a weekly half hour, plus or minus, show that is a collaborative space shared by four of our community's advocacy organizations, including Lowcountry Local First, the Coastal Conservation League, the Sustainability Institute, and If You Were Mayor, that's me. And while these organizations serve different needs in our community, they're largely aligned in their vision for the future. So Small Talks, Big Ideas is a space for each of these organizations to share their ideas, have tough but necessary conversations, and invite you as listeners into our work. So for today's segment, we welcome Kendra Stewart, who's the director of the Joseph P. Riley Jr. Center for Livable Communities and a professor within the Masters of Public Administration at the College of Charleston. Hello, Kendra. We're so glad you're here today.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Good. Well, we've invited you to talk to us today about public policy and the role of organizations, both public and private, to frame the question of livability in their communities and in a city. And I understand that you've been a participant in a lot of those conversations and a lot of the sort of workings of what that public policy should be in Charleston and in the overall region. So do you mind giving us a little bit of a history of the Center for Livable Communities, how it's functioned in the past, and maybe how it's changing, as we move forward? I mean, I know that it's within the context of a public college, so it doesn't just serve Charleston, but why don't you just tell us a little bit about that?
Sure.
Be great.
Well, the Riley Center was first developed at the College of Charleston back in the 1970s, and it was but it was not the Riley Center at that point. It was sort of a traditional public service institute that many public universities have. And until about 2010, it was an urban policy center, and that was the major focus. But around 2010, a number of faculty got together, and we decided to make it more inclusive to other departments or other areas besides just what was considered political science, as well as focus more specifically on the topics of livable communities. Prior to then, mostly what the Riley Center did was survey research and data collection, working with local governments on professional development and a number of federal grants. And then when 2008 hit and money shrunk at the federal level, a lot of that federal grant money ended. And so the center had to rethink what it was going to do. And at that same time, the number of nonprofits began to explode in this area. And part of that came from stimulus money or other things. And that they suddenly nonprofits were beginning to develop that didn't have a lot of capacity or a lot of experience. And so we started to fill that need and work a lot more with nonprofits. Today, our major focus, we still have the mission of pairing the intellectual resources of the college with the community, and trying to bring faculty, staff, and students into community organizations to build capacity and provide services that they wouldn't be able to do without that. And today, the Riley Center does that through five focus areas, and that's nonprofits and local government, health and sustainability, public safety, education, arts, and culture, and urban design, planning, and housing.
Sweet. Well, that's a lot more than your website actually suggests right now.
We're trying to keep it secret.
Well, you can make this the official announcement,
that's right.
I think. Well, I just let's back up a little bit. My interest in inviting you today is some sort of rolls back a little bit. Obviously, the If You Were Mayor website has a lot to do with some of the mission and purpose that
yes.
you frame within the Center for Livable Communities, and I think it's just fantastic. And I think our focus has been on the concept of participatory. You know, that democracy is really about participation and engagement. So I think back to a book that I read several years ago called The Metaphysical Club by the American historian Louis Menand. And he provided some historical background on kind of the shape of the American democracy after the Civil War, particularly. And there were various historical figures he pointed at, and that John Dewey, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Charles Sanders Peirce, and William James, and that they were concerned with the effects of industrialization and the use of scientific method thinking to legitimize democracy. And it was a time when they were getting more, they were opening up the vote to more people. It was sort of a beginning of a process over a number of years where that was beginning to happen. And there were not just property owners involved. They referred to it as the democratic experiment. It was still considered the democratic experiment, especially after the Civil War. And one line of reasoning was that a decision made by a government really wasn't democratic unless everyone had been permitted to participate in it. And that's a pretty big, you know, sort of charge. And especially when you think about how few people vote and how few people sort of take advantage mm-hmm. of those processes. What's happening? What's changed in our democracy over the last 120 years or 150 years? And are we at a point where that's kind of changing, or what mechanisms have brought that about? So, and one of the things that you do, I know, involves surveying and polling and data collection, and I think those processes are changing the way that people think, think about how they can engage or how they should be engaged. They're maybe not the traditional polling and things. I mean, I don't pick up the phone if I see that sort of unknown or something. And so it's how is this process working now, or how is it changing now, so that there's a wide range of opinions and leanings that are really represented in our local governments. And
you know, this is one of the greatest challenges local governments face today, and probably the thing we get asked to do most by local governments is help them figure out how they can better engage their citizens in a productive way. The traditional way, I guess there's been two traditional ways. One is through surveys, and that's generally more political. Political people have mostly done surveys to determine agendas or how they should feel about certain issues, but also through public meetings, just opening it up to letting folks come and let their voice be heard. And that has posed the challenge that really only very small groups of mostly unhappy people come to participate, and it's right. not representative. Whenever I've done a study to look at, you look at comparing the people who've come to speak at a public meeting and how they feel versus how the public feels in general, there's a disconnect. And so local governments who are very interested in knowing what the local citizens think, more so than any level of government, have been struggling with this and trying to determine how they can reach out, especially to citizens who traditionally don't participate. Because what we know tends to happen is what we're seeing going on across this country in places like Baltimore, in Missouri, where when certain groups aren't, when their voices aren't heard for long periods of time, there tends to be an eruption. Right. And that becomes unsettling. And, you know, you point out some of the challenges with polling, that when we started polling back around the Great Depression, 90% of people responded who were called. Today, it's in the single digits. Right. And so there's all types of methodological questions, and it's very difficult to get the groups that you want to hear from most, which are the groups that tend to be more silent. They are the least likely to, minority groups, younger folks are the least likely to respond to surveys. So you have to be today more creative in how you engage the public and get this information from them.
We've sort of in-house have had all kinds of discussions about, and I think it's the idea of the generations of people with young children, the idea of going to a public meeting in the evening, it's kind of, it's as though they don't, there's no way they can be a participant in, you know, their worlds are kind of rocked by child rearing and ways that technology can do that. And I think that is an evolving arena, that the Knight Foundation has been pretty, you know, aggressive, yes, about trying to get people thinking in terms of how can you use technology to get people more engaged. And it's certainly an experiment that we've been doing. And it's kind of exciting. You know, people really do feel empowered when there's a tool, you know, just right, a tool that they feel like gives them a little bit more entry into the conversation.
And the great thing about technology is that you can do that on your own time. More and more people do have access to it today. And what we're seeing most being done right now is generally some kind of mixed method of outreach, because if you still want to reach certain populations, like the older population, using a landline is often the only way to right, get a good response from that. But yeah, younger generations and even demographics of folks who we traditionally wouldn't think of as being terribly technically savvy are, and have access, especially through a smartphone,
right,
to other ways to engage that we are just now starting to, you know, think about.
And then the Russians hack.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's in, and one of the things that's come up in conversations as of late is that the elective officials who say that their constituency, that they represent a constituency to take a certain position, and the voice of maybe others who don't give a call directly to the office of their councilman or don't feel that they actually have a voice, for instance, they kind of are crowded out. So how does this change the idea of constituencies? I mean, I think that individual elected officials, you know, when we talk in big, you know, sort of big picture, the thinking about wanting to get more opinions and those kinds of things, that's kind of that feels like something that the bureaucracy, and I use that in a positive way, the bureaucracy wants to make sure that there's a kind of a foundation of the work that's being done at the governmental level. And I guess the real question is, how do you drive that home, that same kind of awareness to, and I guess it's just a function of, oh, well, then you elect them or you don't elect them. But the idea of constituency still seems to be embedded in the kind of the circle of friends or the kind of mm-hmm. concentric rings that sort of exist around elected officials. And you say you do some professional development,
yes,
of those kinds of people. So how do those kinds of messages, how do you share those kinds of thoughts or the idea of constituencies and representative government, I guess, is partly the question.
Right. And, you know, that is the challenge. And we're seeing that, I think, play out in a lot of the local governments in this area today, that people have become so certain constituent focused that it's hard to do really good regional planning or thinking
right,
about the bigger picture, because folks are so concerned about a very small group. And again, votes and money still control elections. And so you're right. You know, there are two groups that we tend to focus on. And one, or that can help, I think, work with this problem. And one is the professional public servants that you mentioned,
mm-hmm,
the bureaucrats who, and almost every case I've experienced, really are interested in citizens in general rather than voters.
Right.
And there's a distinction, right? And so they tend to, of course, be responsive to the elected officials, but still have, and depending on the type of local government you have, but if you have a city manager-run government, they have a lot more ability to have the leeway to do that. And there's, in the field of professional local government management, there is a very high ethical standard on citizen engagement and citizen outreach of all citizens, not just ones who are going to show up at meetings or polls. And then, of course, we have advocacy groups, as you mentioned earlier. Right. And that's one reason we've seen a proliferation of advocacy groups, is to represent people who are, whose voices aren't heard or who aren't as good at or as effective at organizing, or who don't have financial or other resources to represent themselves. And so there's, you know, we have some really great and concrete evidence that they've been effective over the last several decades of, you know, representing the poor or children or abused, you know, folks who tend to be unheard, and because they don't vote and they don't give money and they don't show up at meetings. And so there's been a reliance, I think, on these two entities, which are groups we work with quite a bit and trying to help. You know, a number of nonprofits have come to us and asked us to help them collect the same kind of information from their clients, and what we found, what it is that they want or what they need from their organization or what their opinions are, so they can represent those voices. And we tend to do that in a very different way than we would for a government, you know, rather than polling, we use focus groups or, you know, specific outreach, you know, to very particular events, because as you mentioned, they don't have time to show up to meetings.
Right.
If you're working an hourly wage job, you can't just leave, you know, there's a cost, there's a financial cost more than just a time cost to participating. And we try to equal that out so that there is no cost to someone to participate in their government, which is their, you know, given right here in this country.
Oh, that's a cool thing. That's a cool, I mean, that's a cool notion, is to basically sort of bring it back around and emphasize the need to really make that availability something that is not a cost, you know, and that's not just among the poor and the hourly wage. That's among a fairly significant demographic, I think, where the trade-offs and yes. to participate, and so. I mean, that's certainly been a lot of the discussion around voter ID and so let's back up. I mean, or just fold into the same conversation the idea of kind of disruption, because now, you know, we've had advocacy groups and we've had and now we have groups like Black Lives Matter that don't think that they're being represented by the advocacy groups or that tend to be younger voices. And a different perspective, and really want their own voices heard in a very specific way. And has that been in the conversations, for instance, that, I mean, this is something very recent, obviously, and giving rise to these voices that are almost like the voices that we heard in the 60s, you know? It's sort of like, you know, you think you represent me, but you don't represent me. Let me tell you what I'm about. That kind of position. It was certainly the reason why, you know, that kind of tension was part of the taking over the president's office at Columbia University in the 60s. It was really a black-white issue, and people don't necessarily know that so much. But in Morningside Heights, you know, which they're building, expanding the campus, and he said no, but the white students kind of overwhelmed the fact the position really that black students held, and it's kind of an interesting moment in time, and I guess, but that obviously is a little more, I guess that requires even more kind of walking along the ridgeline.
Yeah, I mean,
delicate handling.
Completely. And, you know, it's even when we have advocacy groups, you know, one political science who studied interest groups basically argued that they sing with an upper class accent, you know, that we still end up, you know, money and power and privilege still ends up kind of controlling these groups as well. And there's a fine line between becoming paternalistic and, you know, we're going to do what's right for this group because we feel, you know, even though we aren't part of them or, you know, that we feel like it's right. The right thing to do and trying to draw that line. And that's why, I mean, it is a fine line. And governments have struggled to, you know, to try to not allow that to happen to some degree. And, you know, again, it is a challenge because elected officials tend to respond most clearly to people who vote and right. who support them. And these groups who have often felt marginalized don't feel like their vote matters, don't feel like it's a good use of their time to, you know, give their voice to issues because they feel like they're ignored. And so it really takes effort on behalf of government to get folks involved who traditionally aren't, the people who don't have financial resources, traditionally young people. And we have seen a number of successful efforts, I think even locally, uh-huh. like the Illumination Project.
Right. Right.
That has realized, you know, they have started by holding meetings and letting people come, and they didn't have great attendance by the groups right. they wanted to hear from most. And so they said, okay, we need to find out where these groups are already meeting and go to them. And that's what they have spent the last several months doing, is going onto the college campus to try to get the voice of college students, going into the East Side neighborhood meetings to listen to to folks. They've, you know, had specific meetings with the Hispanic population as well as the gay and lesbian population, you know, and again, not just waiting for them to show up at meetings we're holding.
Right, right.
But
targeted,
know, targeting targeted meeting. And going to where something is already taking place. And that's what a number of local governments across the country have found, is if they want meaningful input from their citizens, they need to show up at farmers markets and have booths in which they can get quick 30-second input from citizens.
Right.
Whether it's dropping a you know, a nickel in a bucket to represent how they think the budget should be spent of the city, or you know, putting stickers on a map to identify where they feel like crime is happening or blighted areas of their community. And so, you know, I've seen a number of efforts nationally. And in Charleston, there has been a concerted effort over the last few years to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, they've gone, one group has gone into a handful of communities to do community assessments.
Right.
To ask the citizens in that local community, what is it that you think are the strengths of your community? Where do you see the weaknesses being? And what is it that you need the city of Charleston to do to empower your community or to make it better? And what is it that you as citizens need to be doing?
Right.
How can we empower you to make things better? And that's really the direction when governments go in, where we see success is when we see governments empowering the citizens to do what they feel like needs to happen in their own communities.
Well, when you say success, what would be some of the marks of success? You know, what are some of the things that we want to be on the lookout for? You know, when you say they've been successful, that these people are having their voices heard, and there have been things that have happened that have complemented mm-hmm. their desires, I guess, or needs. Or
sure. A lot of some of the traditional measures we've looked at have been things like crime and so forth. When you dig a little deeper, what I would say what we're looking for is and I'll use public safety as an example, and communities where there's lack of trust in government, people don't cooperate with the police,
right.
even when they're aware of a crime. And we know this is true. And we just did a really interesting study here and found that with the African American community, the more positive interactions they have with police, the more positively they feel about police. And that, so that it's not some ingrained attitude that people are born with, that
right.
it's based on their interactions. And so that they're also much more likely to work with police and resolving issues. And so that's one measure we can use.
And it seems so simple.
Yes. Yes. Well, ironically, though, helpful interactions between police and white citizens does not have the same impact.
Right.
That it's actually remained steady, that I could have 10 positive interactions with police and I would still just feel the same as I did before I had any interactions with the police.
Ah, okay.
So we have been able to learn some things like that. We've also learned that with young folks, that if they see police officers and don't interact with them, they actually have a more negative attitude towards police than if they never see a police officer at all. But if they see a police officer and have a conversation with them, it significantly can positively impact how they feel about police. So as we learn these types of things, we have an opportunity to say, hey, you know, these little things can make a difference, and we can see people's attitudes change, which result in behavioral changes. So suddenly then we have a community who is working with the police and resolving issues rather than trying to just protect their own, even if it's a criminal element.
Right.
And that happens in all communities, not just poor or lower income or minority communities.
Right.
You know, we see that in upper class white communities as well, protecting their own. And so, there's other things as well, things such as we know when people have a more positive feeling about their community, we see cleaner streets,
mm-hmm.
we see higher levels of volunteerism, and we see more of a collaborative effort between government and citizens rather than the expectation that, you know, citizens have of government to come in and fix the problems.
Right.
There's more of a partnership.
Oh, that's really enlightening. I like that. I mean, I think that's really a very cool thing. I mean, one of the things that we in our own kind of research, we found that obviously local government functions very different than other kinds of government because
right.
it's sort of a bit more pragmatic. And that if you've got a problem, they've got to fix it, or there's sort of a short distance between mm-hmm. the I need something and something needs to be done. And you've basically overlaid kind of how that functionality, the sort of perception of functionality at the local level, can be enhanced by really, I hate to use the word, but kind of tweaking just the way we have interactions in very specific ways and it not necessarily place a burden on people, but just mm-hmm. but just say, you know, this is kind of just kind of a be nice.
Well, and you know what we learned is that a lot of times it's simply a lack of information or understanding. So we worked with one community here in particular in which we used graduate students from the College of Charleston to do interviews and then met with some representatives from the city to say, here are the things that this neighborhood identifies as issues with their neighborhood. And a few of them were things the city could address.
Right.
A number of things were things the citizens thought the city was supposed to be taking care of, but the city actually couldn't. And then other things were for a third party. And again, the neighborhood didn't realize this. So when we brought these folks into the community, the city was able to say, here are the things that we can do. We've heard you, and we are going to clean up this empty lot that the government owns, and we are going to do this and this and this. However, here are things that we need you to do, and we will help you. We cannot go on to these abandoned house properties and throw people off of their private property, even though they're loitering, unless you can find those people who own those houses, and they give us the ability to do that.
Right.
Right? You know, and people didn't realize, they just assumed that, well, this is a problem, so the government should take care of it. And once the local government was able to go in there and say, you know, these are things that we can do. These are things, this issue that you're having with this one piece of property, that's actually owned by SCE&G. And you need to, and they, you know, once they've realized these things, they can then feel empowered to address these
proactive
problems themselves. And then they also feel like it's not just that the government doesn't care about them, so they're not doing these things. They become more aware of the fact that, oh, these are things that the government can't do.
Right.
And now they've helped me understand how we can do that. And, you know, one of the most interesting challenges this neighborhood faced was there was this aging population that was afraid to come out of their houses because of the young folks. and a misunderstanding of what the young folks were doing in their neighborhood.
Right.
And once we were able to get some groups together and the young people were saying, oh my goodness, why would they be afraid of us? You know, we're playing cards or
right.
And there was much more of an outreach then from the younger population to the older population to, you know, to get rid of some of those fears or to dispel
right.
some of those myths that existed. And it was a very interesting conversation. And I think it did change somewhat the face, you know, of that neighborhood. And some of those problems were somewhat internal communication problems.
Right.
But others were problems that the local government just either wasn't aware of or didn't have the ability to address.
This seems like things that need to be disseminated in a much bigger way. I mean, this sort of feels like hidden knowledge, but it should be something that we learn more about. And of course, that's what we're supposed to be doing here
right.
today. And but even this vehicle, I mean, through as many kinds of ways as possible. So I applaud what you're doing, and hope that we can make sure that this kind of concept is actually kind of reaches a bigger audience than just the study group of the day.
Right. No, that would be fantastic.
Going back to kind of the local government and the way it operates, do you ever find yourself you've given a task, you've gone in, it sounds like you have, where the government can't do things, but these other groups can? Do you ever find yourself sort of saying, oh, these are advocacy groups that are sort of operating in that space? I mean, I it's one thing to say, oh, the government does A, but they don't do B.
right.
Do you ever point people to that sort of other groups that might be help them?
Completely. One of the things we like to do is try to bring multiple groups to the table for conversation. And because, over the last couple of decades in Charleston, we've seen this tremendous growth in nonprofits. And a lot of times, these smaller nonprofits don't even know other nonprofits
right.
exist in the same arena. And a lot of times it's not nonprofits too. It's, you know, there's a
sure,
academic
sure.
at the institute, at the university or the college or the
right.
citadel, or there's, an office in the local government, and there's a branch office from the state government, all folks operating in the same arena. So we do like to bring people to the table for conversations about that. In today's world, all of the research argues that most problems are no longer solved by these siloed entities, that they're solved by what we call networked governance.
Right.
And that government is solving very few problems on their own, that they're heavily reliant on these public-private partnerships.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so that's one area that I'm always interested in that I study is what is it that makes some networks successful and others not? Because the challenge in trying to solve problems through a network of folks is there's often a lack of accountability, right? When you have too many people,
right.
who in the
Cooks
end
in
is
the
responsible,
kitchen.
Right? And issues like obesity, that's a great example of one that's been addressed through networks of folks, right? Private doctors, hospitals, public grants for healthy
right.
initiatives, as well as local government issue, you know, initiatives in particular, because it ends up being a public problem when government has to pay for insurance for people who become ill because of this. But the challenge then becomes when you have so many people working on different issues, how can you ensure that the end goal is all the same and people
you
are working
really
together?
You can't really measure. It's hard
yes.
to measure.
And, right. and then when you fall short, who do you blame?
Right.
But right. there are ways, there are lots of examples where that has been successful. And really, in today's world, it is the only way that problems are solved.
Right. Right. I mean, it was interesting for if you were mayor, we sort of consider ourselves kind of a conglomerate that includes a spectrum of nonprofits. And we all convened in the mayor's office a month ago and got a bit of a briefing on what they were up to. And it was like, you know, we're all willing to help, you know, the government,
right.
the sort of new administration had so many things on their plate, and you realize that there was really it was going to be very difficult for all of those things to be successful, and that all of the players at the table really did feel a willingness and a real dedication to sort of seeing successes come out of so many of the things that were sort of brought up. So it's interesting. What you're saying is in fact the reality of what we're witnessing. I mean, at many, many, many levels. And it comes back to the, you know, your point about accountability, back to the metaphysical club. I mean, in that book, mm-hmm. Oliver Wendell Holmes made a comment about, you know, how important free speech was, but then in fact, inherent in free speech is risk.
Right.
And, you have the risk of who's accountable. You have the risk of explosions, you mm-hmm. know, people really having endured kind of a seeming lack of voice for so long, and feel like now it's, you know, now is our time. And I think that, you know, that risk is something it's something we just have to accept. I mean, you know, we've, and perhaps even enjoy, which really strikes me the way you look at this. You must enjoy this because of your right. Because I can't imagine otherwise. So this sense of community, it's a sort of livable communities concept, really is a reinforcement or an extension of a sense of community. I mean, you have to even have a sense of community at all in order to even aim for a livable, you know, to what we kind of vaguely call livable communities, and that democratic kind of back to that democratic experiment. You know, we see so much divisiveness, and you've hinted or mentioned a few things that sometimes it's just lack of information, and I think because there are so many outlets. You know, so many outlets of communication, it seems very, very difficult to say, oh, you know, the, you know, when I was young, there were three networks on television and everyone got, everyone got their information sort of the same way. There was, and everybody was watching the same shows. And, but now we have so many different, and oftentimes, kind of stratified sources of information.
Oh, completely.
What are some of the challenges there that you see from your perspective? I mean, is there really an opportunity? I mean, for ways of using technology that we've not, I mean, it would seem ripe for some type of use of technology or media, the concept of media, in order to sort of message in a more cohesive, embracing, engaging way.
No, I agree completely. It is a challenge, though, getting everybody to adhere to one type of technology. You know, a couple of years ago, a local nonprofit asked us to reach out to their clients to figure out what was the best way to communicate with them. And we came back and we said, well, it's mail, email, landline, cell phone, text. You know, it depended on.
Right.
And there were enough folks in each group that we had to say, listen, this group of people said they will not answer their cell phone. These older folks will not answer their cell phone unless they know the person, and they're only going to respond if you mail them a letter and invite them to something. And this group of young people don't even get their mail out of the mailbox and don't own a landline, and they don't even answer their cell phone. You have to text them. And, right. You know, and so that is a challenge. And even I do think there is an opportunity. I mean, we have seen, you know, this sort of happen in news, as far as now everybody can sign up for a news service that aggregates news specific right. to your own interests.
But of course, that discounts the other side.
Exactly. Or, yeah. Then you're only, and that is the problem with technology, is we've been able to create a space where we can only read what we want to read and hear what we want to hear and listen to what we want to listen to and get the information that we want. And so sometimes it is frustrating as a public official when, you know, someone writes a letter to the editor and said, no one told me this was going to happen in my neighborhood. And the person can say, we did 22 public meetings on this topic. And I was involved with a group where this was the case, where we put all the, you know, we did, you know, countless numbers of events, and still people didn't even recognize that that was happening, even though we had 800 participants, you know, that you're still leaving people out. And, you know, until everyone is, you know, and I don't know, this might take a generation, and who knows, by then technology will change again. But a number of local governments have had success with apps that if it's one central place that people can get information from. And, you know, Charleston County's been trying to do that with the phone message, where everybody can sign up to get emergency messages. And, you know, trying to centralize that is certainly a challenge. And an opportunity, I guess, I mean, as you point out.
I mean, that's really what I, you know, that you know, every problem, every issue is theoretically an opportunity. But I mean, it's hard to get your hands around something like that. I mean, you know, I feel very lucky that here in Charleston, for instance, we have a locally owned newspaper. When, you know, that it's not perfect, and it doesn't give us many of those kind of deep dives. It hasn't published information about what you're doing, but at the same time, we get a certain amount of local coverage that a lot of places really just don't have.
And then there's a number of even smaller locally owned papers, and, you know, the Moultrie paper, the James Island paper, which I guess doesn't exist, the city paper, other, you know, that there are other outlets that are specifically focused on our local issues.
Well, I, you know, it's it does seem, from what we've talked about today, that democracy is really a way of finding voices. I mean, you know, that voices and opinions and ideas, and they come from many, many corners. And you know, the realization that we, that our democracy is really founded on ideas, is very important to sort of recognize. It's not founded on freedoms. It's not founded on liberties. It was really founded on ideas, and a freedom of ideas, and a way of expressing ourselves, either through religion or other kinds of ways that there was accountability. And and I, at some level, that's really, you know, having a voice means that you can, in fact, ensure that there's accountability in our in the people who hold public office, and that's, you know, it's maybe more challenging when there's 25 different organizations and the local government involved, but it really is enlightening, and actually very exciting to hear kind of the level at which you and the Center for Livable Communities is really working, and it shouldn't be in the background quite so much. But
thank you.
And we could talk about this, I'm sure, this kind of wonkiness for a while. But that notion of information gathering and reaching out to people is certainly a challenge. I mean, Brian Stevenson, when he visited here, with the, he's the, he wrote a book called Just Mercy. He's what's it called? The, not the Innocence Project, but it's in Alabama. And he said there are four things, you know, that you need to make sure that you, in order to sort of heal, in his case, the racial sort of divide. He said you have to have proximity. You need to know that it's going to be uncomfortable. And it's going to be, it's not going to be easy. and that there's a hope that it can actually happen, you know? And that if you can maintain that sort of core, then you really can realize change and involvement. So I think if we can, you know, it does seem like you, in essence, are working on that proximity to sort of make sure that everyone feels included. And I think that's just great. And I hope that continues and whatever it takes to keep you there.
Thank you.
As long as possible. But it wouldn't be right if I didn't conclude with the question, what would you do if you were mayor?
I think I would give away free ice cream. So Andrew Jackson, when he was president, did free cheese at the White House once a month, where people could come and get a piece of cheese and tell the president what their problems were or what their ideas were.
Right.
So I think I would give free ice cream at City Hall once in a while and hear what people have to say.
That might have different implications than the cheese, because I'm not sure about Andrew Jackson. but that's great. Well, thank you, Kendra, for joining us this week, and next time my phone looks like a pollster, I'll actually answer it, maybe.
That would be good. Could be me.
It could be you. If you could just call it sometime other than dinner time. Sure. That's the only thing. And so that wraps up this segment of Small Talks, Big Ideas with If You Were Mayor. And again, we invite you to go online to our Facebook page to submit your questions, feedback, and ideas for this segment. Next week, tune into Small Talk, Big Ideas for your chance to hear from the Lowcountry Local first. And I believe they're going to be talking to some people at the food bank. And thank you for tuning in to 96.3 FM Ohm Radio Charleston and supporting your local nonprofit radio station. We'll see you in about a month.
Thank you.
Thanks.